Definition of blind rage. Rage can sometimes lead to a state of mind where the individual is capable of doing things that may normally seem physically impossible. A person in rage may also experience tunnel vision, muffled hearing, increased heart rate, and hyperventilation. A person in a state of rage may also lose much of the capacity for rational thought and reasoning, and may act violently on impulses until the source of their rage is destroyed. People in a rage have described experiencing things in slow motion and may suffer a form of amnesia regarding the incident itself. Chapter 1, May 16, 1981. Ruiyan Park glanced at herself in the bathroom mirror. Her head was covered with 30 pin curls, held in place by 30 bobby pins. On her chest were red splotches, sure signs she was angry. She grabbed her pink nylon robe from the hook behind the door and threw it over her matching nightgown with an exaggerated motion that made the robe fan out in a half circle. Joan Crawford had donned a robe with the same flair in one of her early gangster movies, The Damned Don't Cry, and Ruiyan thought she favored the movie star. She returned to the guest room and sat on the bed, crossing her arms over sagging breasts, impatiently waiting for the apology that never came. Instead, she felt the first of 10 hacking blows to the top of her head and left temple. She screamed and struggled to fend off her attacker, grabbing hands, hair. Blood spurted and ran down her face and onto her neck and chest. She fought hard and broke 2 fingers on her left hand and cut her right. She fell over onto the foot of the bed, soaking the mattress with blood. And then she felt hands around her ankles. She was dragged off the mattress, face down across the hard floor, down the hallway, and across a rug that bunched under her. She raised her left arm, knocking books from a shelf in the den. Finally, she lay still, the metallic scent of the blood pooling under her head filling her nostrils. She felt something thrown over her, and seconds later she heard the den door open and quietly close. At first, the 75-year-old widow didn't realize how badly she was injured, but she could feel the sticky blood on her neck and arms. Her head throbbed worse than any migraine she'd ever had, and when she tried to lift it, she couldn't. Her throat was dry, and she wished for a sip of water. Minutes passed before she lost consciousness, and her last thoughts were of how she would ever get rid of the bloodstains in the show place of Van Buren, Arkansas. Chapter 2, May 17, 1981. Sam Hugh Park awakened around 11 on Sunday morning with the sun shining behind old and uneven Venetian blinds. Hungover as usual, he stumbled into the kitchen of the small house he rented from his mother. With a shaking hand, he reached for the bottle of vodka he kept in the refrigerator, took a long swallow, and immediately felt some relief. He walked into the living room, where his newest boy, Santos, was asleep on the couch. He tousled his long black hair. "Get up," he said, and jabbed his ribs with his hand. But Santos only stirred slightly and rolled over.
"Fuck it,"
Sam Hughes said. He heated a cup of coffee in the microwave and walked out onto his small front porch. He realized he had slept in his clothes and noticed a semen stain on his yellow sweater. He briefly wondered whose it was. Across the street at his mother's house, her morning paper still lay on the sidewalk where she demanded it be thrown.
"Mom hasn't gotten her paper yet?"
he said aloud, and then laughed, realizing he was talking to himself more and more these days. Ever since he'd lost his job as the youngest U.S. prosecuting attorney of the 5th District of the state of Arkansas, he found the most interesting conversations were those he had with himself. He had made good money, but he spent it foolishly on liquor and entertainment with other homosexuals, sometimes supporting as many as 3 young men he had rescued from the county jails.
Now he lived in one of his mother's three rent houses and hung his shingle out in the front bedroom. He did not have a thriving legal practice, but there weren't that many lawyers in Van Buren, so he billed enough clients that he was able to employ a secretary. He went back inside and met Santos coming out of the bathroom. "I tried to wake you up earlier," he said to the boy, who was clad only in his underwear. Santos was currently Sam Hughes' favorite, and Santos wanted to keep it that way. He lived there rent-free, with all the beer and drugs he wanted. "Got anything you want me to do today?" he asked. "Well, you can pick up the place. I had people in and out all night, but alas," he said with a chuckle, "I don't remember who they were." "Anything else?" Sam Hugh unzipped his pants. "Yeah." A couple of hours later, after Santos had left to go horseback riding, Sam Hugh walked outside again and saw his mother's newspaper still lying where it had been earlier. He and his mother fought bitterly and often over his excessive drinking and fondness for young boys, but they always made up. He had talked to her on the phone the night before and remembered the conversation. "Oh, Sammy, I'm so tired from that bus trip to Cincinnati, but I think I got everything I need for my new book," she said. Sam Hugh knew she used trips for tax deductions, but he played along, mainly because he needed to borrow some money. "Steamships on the Arkansas River should be interesting," he said. "But you need to take a break from it and relax." "Oh, I have. I've been watching the PTL show, and Tammy Faye told the sweetest Memorial Day story. That's coming up, you know. Oh, yeah, there was a wonderful gospel trio from Kentucky on the show, too." "I watched a movie on HBO," Sam Hughes said. "Holy Moses. I laughed all the way through it. That short guy Dudley Moore was in it." "You shouldn't watch movies that make fun of the Bible. I forbid it." "Oh, Jesus," he thought as he remembered the phone conversation. "How long will I have to put up with her?" Humming "Slow Hand" by the Pointer Sisters, he walked across the street with the keys to his mother's house in his hand and picked up the rolled newspaper, thick with ads from stores like Wild Bill Engel's Appliances that sold 19-inch television sets for $399.98. and under-the-counter dishwashers for $249.95. Hunt's department store advertised ankle-strap sandals for $19.98 and a taffeta dress for $38.99. He unlocked the kitchen door at the back of the house. There were two other entrances, but this was the one he used when he visited her. "Mother," he called. The house felt cold for such a warm afternoon. "Mother." He saw his mother's house shoes on the kitchen floor and thought that was strange. A sick feeling hit him that maybe she'd fallen down the basement stairs just off the kitchen, but he saw nothing suspicious there. He stepped into the den and saw her body on the floor, partially covered with a yellow quilt or something like that. And for a second, a ridiculous thought popped into his head that she could be taking a nap. With her bare buttocks exposed, she lay on her stomach next to a wing-back chair. Her bloody head was turned to the side, under which a good bit of blood pooled on the wooden floor. He walked closer and knelt down for a better look. He felt lightheaded and thought he might faint or vomit. He felt bile rising into his throat, and he was desperate to get away from the sight on the floor. He turned into his mother's kitchen and dialed the police. "I've got an emergency here," he said. 411 Fayetteville Road. And then he went outside, sat down on the grass, and cried until the police arrived. Chapter 3. County Sheriff Trellin Ball received the call about the homicide of Ruiann Park shortly after he'd finished his Sunday dinner of a roast and potatoes and carrots. His wife Ruby had put the blue metal roaster in the oven before they left for Sunday school at the First Baptist Church. The Balls and their two daughters lived in Alma, a town even smaller than Van Buren, but both cities were in Crawford County. Alma was also the home of a religious group that had moved to the area, founded by Susan Alamo and her husband Tony. They built dormitory housing for their converts and a nice home for them to live in. Susan had grown up in a little community called Dyer, northeast of Alma, and had returned after becoming an evangelist with some followers out in California. Tony gathered up wayward souls to see the light and put them to work in a variety of businesses he started, such as home builders, restaurants, and even a clothing business that produced elaborate sequined costumes for performers to wear in Nashville and Hollywood. Many people thought the Alamos were a cult and wanted nothing to do with them. But because they were all registered voters in Crawford County, Trellin Ball courted them. He needed their votes for sheriff, and he got them. So did the mayor of Dyer, Fayette Peavy. On Sheriff Ball's drive to Van Buren, he recalled the many times he'd seen Mrs. Park. Before she and her husband Hugh divorced, they'd published the local newspaper, the Press Argus. Hugh had died of a heart attack some years back. As far as he knew, Mrs. Park lived alone. He ran into her in the courthouse now and then when she was looking up abstracts or marriage licenses or divorce decrees or tax liens. She imagined herself the town historian and genealogist, and she was forever publishing articles in historical journals around the state. What he remembered most was that she usually looked like she just woke up and forgot to comb her dyed red hair. But she never forgot the bright red lipstick or the rose rouge that circled her cheeks. Galoshes sometimes covered her feet, even on the sunniest of days. The Park home was a lovely red brick with two white pillars on either side of the front porch. It sat near the top of Logtown Hill, as the locals called that section of Arkansas Highway 59, also named Fayetteville Street. The area was once called Signal Hill because signals were sent from the stagecoaches on the famous Butterfield Trail to the livery stable in town, estimating their arrival time. Wagons delivering the mail traveled this way from Missouri to Memphis before being put out of business by the Pony Express, Indians, and marauding gangs of bushwhackers. At the bottom of the hill sat the main street of sleepy little Van Buren, where the Frisco train station had been turned into a tourist attraction. Across the street was the Cottage Cafe, the gathering place for old men to have breakfast and hash over politics, and where come Monday morning they would all be talking about the murder of Ruyen Park. Farther down Main and close to the Arkansas River, the Crawford County Courthouse sat, majestically surrounded by ancient oaks, complete with a fountain. It looked like pictures of genteel plantation homes in states deeper south than Arkansas. But the Park home on the top of Logtown Hill was not the picture of southern gentility when Sheriff Ball turned into the driveway. Several cars and trucks were already there, and yellow crime scene tape had been loosely strung around the back driveway. He parked behind the house in an area backed by thick woods. A brick sidewalk ran along the east side and joined a small porch supported by several rows of brick steps. He doubted anyone ever knocked on the front door, except for maybe a Mormon or a Jehovah's Witness. Wayne Hicks, the assistant police chief of Van Buren, a tall, fat man with several chins, greeted the sheriff, who could stand to lose some weight himself. Don Taylor, trim and muscled up, was an investigator with the Arkansas State Police. He wrote furiously in his notebook and didn't look up to acknowledge the sheriff. There was always a good bit of one-upmanship among the law enforcement agencies, and the sheriff quickly realized he was the last to arrive at the crime scene. He felt like a husband who is the last to know his wife is having an affair. "Well, fill me in," the sheriff said in his most official voice. "I got the call around 1:30 p.m., Hicks said. "The victim's son said he called his mother and she hadn't answered, so he went across the street to check on her. He took his keys with him because he knew her doors would be locked. She was real careful about locking the doors," he said. "Man, come on, man, what else?" "He unlocked the kitchen door and found his mother dead in the den." Chief Hicks lowered his voice and pointed toward the man wearing black-rimmed glasses, leaning against the side of the house, smoking a cigarette. "You know who he is, don't you? That queer lawyer, Sam Hugh Park?" "I know him all right. I've been up to his house on some disturbance calls." "I think he done it, don't you? Him or one of his queer friends?" Sheriff Ball shook his head hard from side to side. "Don't jump to conclusions, Hicks. Somebody might hear." The sheriff nodded toward Garrick Feldman, the new owner of the Press Argus, who'd written some unflattering columns about the sheriff's department's connection with a local religious cult.
"I'm sorry, Sheriff," Hicks said. "Nobody heard nothing I said. And you're right, you're absolutely right. I should watch what I say."
Sweat ran down Hicks's cheeks and pulled along his shirt collar. Wet half-moons spread under his arms, and he kept reaching for his handkerchief to mop his brow.
"This is really something," he said. "I'm so wired up, I feel like I might explode."
The sheriff hitched up his pants and tried to tuck in his white shirt. He still wore his Sunday shirt, and it was a little short and a little tight around his belly. He wished he had thought to change into his uniform.
"Well," he said, "I guess I better look at the murder scene."
Sheriff Ball and six other officers, including Investigator Taylor, entered the house through the kitchen door. To the right was a refrigerator, a Harvest Gold model, with blood smeared on the door. Across from the refrigerator sat the stove, and on the floor in front of it, a pair of women's house shoes. The hallway led to the rest of the house. Sheriff Ball let out an audible gasp. Mrs. Park lay on her stomach in the middle of the den, her left arm above her head. Her body was covered in blood, and under her head lay a large circle of what looked like red paint.
"It looks like somebody beat the hell out of her, especially on the top of her head. You agree?"
the sheriff said to Taylor, but he got no response. The sheriff asked another question.
"Is that a Persian rug under her with a quilt over her?"
Taylor still didn't comment. The sheriff pulled on the waist of his pants again. Ruby told him she could always tell when he was nervous because he hitched up his pants.
"That looks like a pillowcase and a napkin by her feet. How come?"
The sheriff realized Taylor was not listening to him, and he felt his face redden. He turned to Hicks and pointed to a long smear of blood.
"Let's see where that trail leads us."
They followed it to the east door, past a floral wingback chair and five or six encyclopedia books strewn on the hardwood floor. Treading carefully into a hallway, they entered the east bedroom, which looked to be a guest room because it was so neat and devoid of any pictures or knickknacks lying around. At the foot of the bed, which had no sheets or other covers, was another large circle of blood, and on the floor at the north side of the bed were other spots.
"Whoever killed her drug her into the den," the sheriff said, scratching his head. "But why? Why not leave her on the bed?"
He looked around the room that contained two dressers and a baby's cradle. A mirror hung over one dresser, and two bedside tables sat on either side of the bed. He supposed they were all expensive antiques, but what did he know about such things? He shopped at Sears if he wanted something really nice. They walked through the rest of the house. The formal living room and dining room appeared to be used only for company. Pale green satin drapes hung at the windows, where a spectacular view opened up on an often photographed scene of the Arkansas River Bridge that connected Van Buren to Fort Smith. The master bedroom was at the back of the house, across the patio from the kitchen. On a bookshelf built into the wall was an unopened black purse, and next to it, three or four framed pictures of young boys.
"Her purse wasn't taken, and the bed doesn't look like it's been slept in," the sheriff said. "The covers have been turned down, though. Looks like she was fixing to go to bed."
A blue telephone, a lamp with a fancy white shade, and some books sat on a table next to the bed. Hicks picked up the phone receiver, listened for the dial tone, and dropped it back in its cradle. He read aloud the titles of the books.
"Lovely Lady" by Harold Robbins, "The Thornbirds" by Colleen McCullough, and "Scruples" by Judith Krantz.
"Never heard of them," he said.
"Of course, how would I know? I hate to read."
He thumbed through the books, looking for notes or scraps of paper, and placed them back where they were.
"Boy, all these books around. Sure did read a lot."
The sheriff remembered his days in grade school, reading the Hardy Boys mysteries, and when he got older, he had checked out all the Tarzan books at the little Alma Library.
I guess she was a real bookworm.
They walked back to the den where Taylor stood with a camera in his hand, taking pictures. He had removed the bedspread, mattress pad, pillowcase, and a pillow from the body. "Come on in, guys," he said to the sheriff. "I think that cover was on the bed. The murderer pulled it all off together when he pulled the body into the den. I think that Persian rug was on the den floor, and it just got jumbled in along with everything else." The sheriff waited a minute before speaking, surprised but pleased that Taylor was including him again.
"That sounds about right," he said with authority. "You think a man did it?"
"Looks like her left hand is broken, with some dark hairs clutched between her right thumb and forefinger," Taylor said. "She tried to defend herself against a man. I'm pretty sure a woman couldn't have done it."
"Well," Hicks said, "she fought to the death trying to defend herself. Pretty good for an old woman."